Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be taking a look at The City on the Edge of Forever. But not in the version which you're familiar with, but in the new audiobook version of Harlan Ellison's original screenplay.
The fully performed audiobook version of the original screenplay.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. But before we get into that, let's talk about some news, shall we?
Let's talk about news, Mike. I look forward to that.
All right. So, the Saturn Awards were last week, and a whole bunch of Star Trek people won Saturn Awards. Nichelle Nichols won a Lifetime Achievement Award. Marianne Brandon and Mary Jo Markey won Best Editing for The Force Awakens. Branham Braga got a Special Recognition Award. William Shatner won Best TV Guest Star for Haven, I think.
Sure, why not? He should win Best TV Guest Star every year, honestly.
Yeah.
If he appears on one show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Haven won the President's Award, and Sean Piller is, working on that show. And Ron Moore won Best TV Fantasy for Outlander, which I have to say, I enjoy Outlander quite a bit. It's a very good show.
Still have to watch it, but hearing nothing but good things about it. And a win at the Saturn Awards is another check mark in the positive column.
The 90-minute second season finale is this weekend, so be ready. Force Awakens also won Best Special Effects. Roger Guyatt and various other people working on that. It won Best Writing. J.J. Abrams, of course, along with that other guy, Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah, Larry. Larry did some writing on that.
Yep. And Force Awakens also won Best Science Fiction Film, which is really cool.
And I'm sure outraged somebody.
I'm sure it did. Probably outraged a lot of people, but, who cares? But another person who won at the Saturn Awards for Best Action Thriller was Brian Fuller, who, of course, is creating the new Star Trek show. And as great as it is that he took home an award, what the rest of us took home was a whole bunch of stuff that he said in the press line prior to the show. There were two interviews in particular. One was with MoviePhone.com, which, hey, I'm so glad that MoviePhone still exists. I really hope that the person who was interviewing him was Mr. MoviePhone, the MoviePhone guy.
Who can think of Movie Phone and not think of Seinfeld? Kramer, you have 3 seconds to open the door.
I always think of Josie and the Pussycats, but that's just me.
Nice. Nicely done.
Did you know that the voice of Mr. Movie Phone is also the voice of the killer in Scream?
No, I didn't know. Well, I know that now. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's almost as cool as the interview that MoviePhone did with Brian Fuller, where he talks about a lot of stuff. A lot of people pulled out, some facts, some things which we didn't know about the show, which were, really cool. Like, for example, he revealed that the rumors about it taking place in between TOS and Next Gen are false. And also the rumors that it's going to be an anthology series. That's false.
Well, but there you go.
But he did reveal something which I thought was really interesting when asked about, his team and Nicholas Meyer in particular and what Nicholas Meyer brought to the table.
Yeah.
Brian Fuller said, well, a clarity and a cleanliness to the storytelling, an ability to ground science fiction in a relatable way, and also making sure that we're telling character stories. I thought that was really interesting.
I think that's really awesome. A statement like that is really, I think, bolstering to me as a fan, because it means that Meyer is serving in the capacity that I think that we would all hope that he would, which is, he does bring a good focus to things. And, the character development. I mean, if you just look at his Star Trek contributions, but even if you look at a movie that's not great, like The Human Stain, with Wentworth Miller and Anthony Hopkins
and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, she is in it.
I went to the premiere of the Human Stain at the Chicago Film Festival back when it came out.
Oh yeah,
I love that movie.
I didn't love it. I didn't dislike it. I thought that this will sound strange, but I actually thought that the casting of Anthony Hopkins was a misstep.
Yeah, no, I can
see
that.
For the film.
Yeah.
I thought Wentworth Miller actually was, because I think by the time I saw it, the only thing I knew him for was Prison Break. And so seeing him in the film, I was like, oh, wow, this guy's really good.
You know, he's a writer, too.
No, I didn't know that.
He wrote this really weird movie called Stoker, which also stars Nicole Kidman, by the way.
Oh.
I don't know. It's a weird, crazy art house movie, and to think that it was written by Wentworth Miller is weird.
Captain Cold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that doesn't have anything to do with The Human Stain or
not
Nicholas
at all.
Meyer.
Not well, yeah. You know, just citing the fact that Meyer's strength is, you know, it's nice to hear that they brought somebody in to keep the focus on the characters, because it really is Star Trek on television is a character-driven thing. You know, it's not action spectacle that happens every so often, but it's about the characters. So I like that.
Yeah, you know, and he's talked about, you know, this and like sort of like the analogy between like Star Trek and Sherlock Holmes, and how like Arthur Conan Doyle didn't get Sherlock Holmes, but he understood how to make it. You know, and he's talked about that in relation to himself. He's like, I don't get Star Trek, but I know how to make it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can definitely see that. You know, I can definitely see you got a bunch of people like Brian Fuller and, you know, all these huge Star Trek nerds. And there's the urge to nerd out, right?
Yep.
Which is definitely something which is beneficial. But it's good to have someone like the guy who's made the stuff that they're nerding out about being like, oh my God, you guys, this is so stupid. This is so boring. I thought we were telling stories. We need to do something. We need to stay on point so that the next generation, no pun intended, nerds out about what we're doing, you know?
Right. Right. So, how are you going to get somebody who's not a Star Trek fan to care about this series?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I like that. I like that. He's keeping them honest. But
yeah, I think also the thing that I glommed onto, which I think some people are twisting this way and that way to mean one thing or another, but something else that Fuller said that really struck me, that I was really happy to hear, was when he talked about, he's like, well, I'm going to mangle it, so I'm paraphrasing here, but you know, he's like, well, we're doing colorblind and genderblind interviews with people, and people took it one way or people took it another way. And where I'm sitting with it is colorblind casting gave us Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear somebody putting a show together saying, well, we have some concepts for the characters, but we're not going to say we need this type. We need this person to look this way. We just want the best actor for this role, and then we will make it work. I think that's really exciting. That means that they really are going into it as we're just making the best character piece we can.
So another person who Fuller talked to at the Saturn Awards was Steve Weintraub of Collider. And Weintraub is, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about him, or maybe it's just the way that I've sort of gotten information or whatever. But for my money, like, Weintraub is one of the best film journalists in terms of like getting really interesting info out of people about to go into a red carpet type event, you know?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
And the stuff that he got from Fuller, because like Weintraub, it's not like he's like, oh, what are you wearing? Of course, you know, he's like, I'm going to pound you for questions until someone tells me that I have to stop. And if you watch the video, that's like literally what it is. And he's just like asking him one after the other. And he got a lot of interesting info out of him. Probably the most interesting thing, if you ask me, is that he found out who the producing director of the new show is. And that's Vincenzo Natali.
Now, as a favor, say somebody like me is listening right now, and we have a vague notion of what a producing director is, but not not the best definition. What role is a producing director?
I would say, and these things tend to be vague by nature, you know, just like showrunner is a vague title, right? You know?
Yeah.
But I would say that producing director is essentially the directing equivalent of a showrunner, you know, mm-hmm. where he'll direct the key episodes. Like he'll probably do the finale, you know, he'll probably do, you know, whatever the big, you know, cliffhangers are or whatever. And, you know, he's responsible for making sure that all of the other directors kind of stay on the same page, you know?
Sure.
Like examples of this, I don't think that Star Trek has ever really had one, strangely enough, although there are people who they go to on a regular basis or did go to on a regular basis. But in terms of like defining tone and everything like that, Michael Reimer on Battlestar Galactica is a perfect example. Okay. You know, he directed the miniseries, he directed the finale. He would usually come in for like the two-parters and stuff like that. And, you know, the look and feel of the show is largely his creation, you know.
Would Fincher on House of Cards be a good example too?
Yeah, it would. And you know, that's the type of thing where, you know, Steven Soderbergh has actually talked about this in relation to House of Cards. And we can't have any show without talking about Steven Soderbergh. But
we made it probably the farthest we ever have into one of our shows without talking about Steven Soderbergh. So proud of you.
He's really into TV now, right? I mean, so much so that he's making it. And he's talked a lot about things like House of Cards. And he saying that, like, one of the big things about television these days, and this sort of like auteur-based television, is that it feels week to week like it's part of a whole, you know? Like, even though House of Cards is directed by like five or six different people, it feels like it's directed by the same person. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because David Fincher established a tone at the beginning. And all of the other directors, and the other directors are people like Joel Schumacher and stuff, who does not have a similar style to David Fincher in the least, but they follow Fincher's lead in terms of crafting the show in a certain way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what the producing director does. There actually have been some Star Trek directors who have gone on to become producing directors on other shows. The one that I think of off the top of my head always is Robert Duncan McNeil. He was the producing director on Chuck.
Yeah.
And that's a case which is interesting and similar to this one in that he did not direct the pilot. The pilot was directed by McGee. But then McGee went off to make, you know, Terminator Salvation or whatever. And Robert Duncan McNeil was handed the reins to the show. And it sounds like that's what's going to be happening here with Star Trek. One of the things which, you know, Fuller specified was that Natale would not be directing the pilot, which lends a lot more credibility to these, you know, rumors and rumblings that Kurtzman is going to direct the pilot himself.
Okay, so, but see, in a situation like that, then, if Natale's going to be the producing director and somebody else gets the pilot, is that just because Kurtzman is a producer and he wants to add that credit to his resume, or he just feels a sense of ownership so he wants to be able to say he did that?
That I think that goes a lot goes on a lot of the time. I mean, another thing which is, you know, a lurking variable there are the guild sort of negotiations and whatnot, and the fact that if you direct a pilot for a show, you essentially get royalties for the entire show.
Gotcha.
You know? But obviously, I mean, Kurtzman, I think, also wants to sort of create the look and feel of the show himself, you know, and he will definitely do that with the pilot, but he's going to go off and make his Mummy movie. So I'm sure that, you know, Kurtzman and Natale are going to sit down and, you know, Kurtzman's going to be like, hey, this is what I want to do. And then Natale will be the one who executes it. You know, and that's not an uncommon thing, you know, like Peter Berg on Friday Night Lights, you know, wrote and directed the pilot and then handed it off to other people, you know, Jeffrey Reiner, I think, in that case. You know, and that happens fairly frequently. And sometimes you do see, like, a huge shift. Sometimes you just see kind of like a refinement. And sometimes you don't even notice it because, you know, everyone's sort of on the same page. But Natale's the guy, so...
Cool.
It's exciting.
The way everything seems to be coming together with this team, it seems like everybody's on the same page already. I don't think that we're going to have any sort of stylistic clashes or issues.
No,
going forward.
And Natalia has worked with Fuller before on Hannibal.
Yes.
He directed 6 episodes of Hannibal, and I know that you've seen at least some of them. He did like 2 in season 2, and then he did, I think, the first 3 in season 3, and then another one down the line. So, yeah. I mean, you're familiar with some of his work, right?
We were talking about the horse one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one stays with you. It definitely stays with you. There were episodes of Hannibal where, as terrific as the show is overall, there are still a couple that sort of like, you know, pop out to you. And I definitely would say that, you know, as I'm calling it, the horse one sticks with you. It really stays with you. You know, anybody who had anything to do with that show, I mean, the fact that he's worked with Fuller before is fantastic. And if he's going to be producing director and he worked on Hannibal and he's bringing his visual sensibilities to things, I am so much even more on board with this series at that moment.
He's done a lot of stuff going way back. Now, I know he did a lot of TV, but back before that, he had directed a few movies here and there. Most notably, I think, to a lot of people, is Cube, which was his first movie, which was a really low-budget science fiction movie, which was really interesting because it had this sort of like high-concept idea, but essentially the entire thing was shot on one set. It was basically a cube, you know, a cube room with some weird lights.
Yeah.
And the idea is like these strangers are thrown into this room together. They don't know what's going on, and they need to basically try to find a way out of this maze by going from like one room to the next, and each room is, you know, the same basic cube but has something unique to it, and they're trying to basically make it through alive, and they don't even know exactly where they are or anything like that. It's really good and really interesting in that it's this big sci-fi concept done on a very low budget, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It became kind of a cult favorite back in the day. It came out in, I think, the late 90s. My friend Zach loves that movie to death, and it actually has had like a couple like sequels, like direct-to-video and stuff, and it's really good. And it also features Nicole DeBoer.
Ezri
Dax. Yeah. So
yeah.
So that's kind of cool. So I would definitely recommend checking that out. He also did a movie recently called Splice, which freaked me out from all of the advertising and everything like that, all of the marketing.
The title is sticking with me for some reason. What was that one about?
It involves like, you know, splicing like animal and human DNA together to create
Island of Dr. Moreau stuff.
Yeah, and yeah. It looks freaky. I'm gonna watch it now, of course, but I remember at the time thinking like, oh, it's a new thing from the guy who did Cube. What is that? Oh, that's the stuff of nightmares right there, which of course it's supposed to be. It's a horror movie. But yeah, definitely going to have to check it out now. But he's also done a lot of TV. He did an episode of Orphan Black. He did an episode of that show Ascension. And he did the last 2 episodes of season 2 of The Strain.
Yeah, which you've were seen, fan. Right? Yeah, oh yeah. Big fan of The Strain. Big, big fan of that show. And the last 2 episodes of season 2 are pretty fantastic. I urge everyone... I don't know that I'm as... you know what? It's a close horse race as to whether Hannibal or The Strain have left me more sort of shuddering at the end of episodes. But I'd say Hannibal, for consistency, at the end of every episode, you're sort of emotionally wrought. Whereas, you know, The Strain every so often throws one in where you're like, yeah, the good guy's got a victory. So, you know, you get a breather every so often. But... yeah, no, the Strain in those 2 episodes in particular are really, really good.
I need to check it out. I love Del Toro, and you know, I just haven't had a chance, but I will. I will. Check
it's
it
amazing
out.
What you can do with the leftover concept from a terrible. Okay, not terrible. It's not Blade Trinity, but like Blade 2 is not the best movie out there. But the creature design was fantastic, and so you take something from a sort of a semi-failed project like that, you say, you know what, this concept was really good, so I'm gonna make a horror show. I mean, you know, we made the books and everything in the comics, but like, and then turn it into a horror TV show where you're like, I'm just really gonna unsettle everybody, and boy does he succeed. Oh my gosh, does he succeed?
Blade 2 is a nearly flawless film, so.
That is wrong.
You're crazy. That You're is crazy. Incorrect. You're the only person I know who doesn't think that Blade 2 is like.
Oh, I'm not the only person I know that thinks this way. So you and your echo chamber over there.
If you want to check out Natali's work with Fuller on Hannibal in particular in season 3, check out Amazon Prime today. Season 3 of Hannibal is now available on Amazon Prime as of today. So
yeah. And hints, Fuller did drop a hint that there's a, however slim, a possibility that Hannibal could come back for a season 4.
Never give up hope.
Never give up hope, man. You never know.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on to our feature for today?
Let's do it. I'd love to.
All right. The City on the Edge of Forever. Now, as most people I'm sure know, The City on the Edge of Forever was the episode of the original series, which was written by Harlan Ellison.
Yes.
It is the Citizen Kane of Star Trek. And everyone who's seen it absolutely loves it, with the exception of one person, Harlan Ellison. And the reason for that is because he does not like the way that the episode as aired was rewritten. His original version had a number of differences, and he had some pretty big arguments with Gene Roddenberry over what should or should not be in this episode, and it resulted in some rather bad blood.
Decades-long feud, I think, is the way we could phrase that.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
And in the mid-90s, Harlan Ellison released a book which contained his original screenplay, or teleplay, along with a very lengthy essay explaining what happened and what the changes are and why he does not like the finished version, and also some afterwords by prominent writers and science fiction personalities and Star Trek people and all that stuff. In an attempt to sort of piece together what went wrong and set the record straight and all that other stuff. And that book is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
We've talked about it on Commentary Trek Stars. That was, I think, not the first time. Yeah, it was one of the first times that we talked.
Yeah, it's one of the earliest ones, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, really great. And over the years, in an attempt to get, I guess, as close to that episode as it was meant to be aired as possible, there have been various incarnations which have popped up of Harlan Ellison's screenplay. A couple of years ago, there was a comic book, which was very good, in my opinion. It was written by the Tiptons, and it's really sort of an interesting idea of what this show would have looked like had it aired as originally written.
Yeah.
And now there's another version of this story, and it is an audiobook version.
Yes. A very good audiobook version from Skyboat Media.
Yes.
And it is it has Ellison narrating his own lengthy diatribe. It has fully cast parts for Kirk and Spock and McCoy. It has people reading stage direction. That is in the original script to. So, I mean, honestly, it comes across very much like a table read.
Mm-hmm.
It comes across a lot the way that with The Force Awakens, I had expected that table read to be presented, where I'd be able to actually hear everybody reading, not just a 4-minute cutout. But anyway, but this is, you know, it's not done like an audio drama. It is just, it's people performing the roles, real actors performing the roles. And actually, Geordi himself, LeVar Burton, opens it up with the intro to the actual teleplay. And they even do the second revised draft. They go through the entire teleplay, and given the history of the rewrites that were requested, you know, to get rid of the jewels of of sound and stuff like that. They have the first two parts as rewritten by Ellison in an attempt to appease Roddenberry and get rid of the human weakness that the original script played into in terms of bad people on the Enterprise, which was apparently from the get-go a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I thought that the audiobook was amazing. I listened to every part of it, including Ellison's I think it's a 2-hour long read.
Yeah, it's like his two parts, and each part are over an hour long.
Yeah, he has a lot to say. I mean, most of it you've read before, but to hear it, I think, gives it a certain amount. Like, I originally wasn't going to, because I'm sort of the mind, after having read it and been familiar with it for so many years, to sort of be like, you know, I get it. You don't like Roddenberry. Roddenberry's a doo-doo head. I gotcha. You know, we're all good on that front. But in all honesty, like, the pain is still so real to him of what happened. And then in one of the afterwards, a friend of Trek FM, Larry Nemechek, reads his own essay in response to Ellison, sort of saying essentially the same thing. We understand, Harlan. We know. We don't have an infallible view of Gene Roddenberry anymore. It's okay. You know, your story's out there. But, yeah, I mean, I loved it. I know I'm rambling on now. What did you think of it?
I liked it a lot, too. You know, it's, I guess I didn't really know what to expect going into it, because, you know, I had heard that it was a full cast and everything. And I guess I thought it was going to be more like an audio drama in a sense. And mm-hmm. Certainly that's there. And that's really interesting. And I think that it's cool because we don't have the episode in a motion picture format.
Yeah.
His original version. But, like, we've got the comic book, and now we have this, and I think putting those two things together, you know, which would be an interesting experiment to, like, read the comic while you're listening to the audiobook. Like, it's something that you could actually do.
Well, I mean, they could put together a motion comic.
You could do that, yeah. Too, yeah. I mean, you could even do that on your own. Now I wish I would have done that. I don't know why I thought not to do it. I think maybe the reason why I didn't think to do it was because I didn't know how close things would be. I mean, since the comic book is a quote-unquote adaptation of the screenplay,
yeah.
But, like, I just read the comic in preparation for listening to the audio drama, and, you know, reading it and then hearing the audio drama, you know, back-to-back within the mm-hmm. span of 24 hours, it's really freaking close, you know?
Yeah.
And you could totally do that. That's actually something which I would recommend people try, you know, because I think it would be a fascinating sort of way to experience this story, especially yeah. when you have things like, you know, the character of Trooper, who Harlan Ellison, you know, calls mm-hmm. like the best character he ever wrote, who is not in the finished episode. This is a character where he was like a World War One vet,
yep.
who basically was, you know, selling apples
and pencils. He had lost his legs, and that was how he was surviving, was selling apples and pencils.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, even to speak to Ellison's point that he says in one of his essays, he's like, everybody remembers World War II, but nobody remembers the people that suffered through World War I. And he was like, that was one of the things about Trooper that was so important to him, was mm-hmm. that there wasn't just one world war in the 20th century. There were two, and they were both awful.
Yeah, yeah. And that character, Ellison said that, you know, he felt like, you know, that character was written by him, for him, in a sense. You know,
yeah.
that was his point of view. You know, and when the comic book was painted Ellison in the role, you know, which, yeah. you know, Ellison said was so, in the afterwards to the comic, Ellison says that he was so moved by that he actually, you know, cried when he heard. And then in the audiobook version, Ellison does the voice of Trooper.
Yeah.
You know,
and he does a really good job. It's a really good performance.
He does. And that's the thing which I think surprised me the most about this audiobook, and the thing which I kind of loved the most about it. You know, the audio drama, you know, the teleplay portion is great. But to me, the thing that's the best about it is Ellison's essay, because I think I've talked about this before elsewhere, but who cares? Yeah. Because Sci-Fi Buzz. Did you ever watch the Sci-Fi Buzz on the Sci-Fi Channel?
I did not, no.
Okay, back before the internet, if you wanted to get news about science fiction, you would watch the Sci-Fi Buzz on Saturday morning on the Sci-Fi Channel. And it was, you know, like a news show, whatever, you know, and they're like, today we're going to this place to talk to this guy, you know, that kind of thing. Today yeah. we're going to, you know, look at this. And every episode ended with an editorial by Harlan Ellison, where basically he had full editorial control, from what I understand.
That's and a dangerous thing with him.
It definitely is.
Oh my
is.
Word, is that dangerous.
Right. And he'd get like 2 or 3 minutes at the end of each episode where he's sitting in his office basically telling everyone who's watching why they're stupid. You know? And this was my first exposure to Harlan Ellison. I mean, I guess at this point I would have seen City on the Edge of Forever, but I yeah. didn't. I wasn't paying attention to who writers were or anything. And I'd, you know, get this sort of, you know, this guy, this, you know, irascible old guy who, you know, would just be yelling at me every week. And I'm like, this is the best thing ever, you know? Like, I remember one that he released right when Superman died. You know, they did the death of Superman. He's like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, Superman's dead. Here, let me show you some. He's like, I've read every Superman comic since 1938 or whatever. And, you know, let me show you some other examples of when Superman died. And he pulls out like this stack of like 50 comics and he's like, here, 1972, here, 1968, you know. He's like, he's coming back. If you don't think he's coming back, then you're an idiot, you know, that kind of thing. It was just that week after week, and it was great. And, you know, then, you know, getting this book, which I probably heard about on Sci-Fi Buzz, you know,
yeah,
you know, and then reading the essay, I was just like, wow, this is what goes on in the making of a television show. And, you know, I would hear Ellison voice in my head, because I had heard him yelling at me for, you know, however many years. And now yeah. to actually hear his voice, right? But 20 years later, where, yeah. you know, he's even older, and his voice has this like raspy tone, which is just amazing. Like yeah. he sounds amazing. And to hear him just, you know, he's still as bitter as he was back yeah. in the 90s. And it is riveting, you know, actually hearing him say this stuff that he wrote 20 years ago. That to me was my absolute favorite part of this. And I definitely would recommend people check it out for sure.
Oh, yeah. Hands down. 5 stars across the board. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And if you want, I mean, too, if you want to experience the Sci-Fi Buzz, you know, Ellison put all of those episodes up onto YouTube, so you can check them out there for sure. Okay, so the other component to this audiobook thing is the afterwards, and mm-hmm. a lot of them were afterwards, which were written by various people back when the original book came out in the 90s, things yeah. like Peter David and David Gerald and stuff like that, DC Fontana, which had the big revelation that she was actually one of the people who rewrote the original script. But there's a few new ones as well. I mean, most notably, Larry Nemechek's.
Yep.
And he actually does it himself, which was fun, because I'm like, hey, yeah. it's like yeah. it's like an extra Larry podcast, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's sort of like when you're watching the behind the scenes stuff on the new Wrathicon Blu-ray, and Larry's on there, and you're like, hey Larry, how you doing?
Yeah, it's fun. And, you know, I think that the thing which is kind of cool to me about that is, like, we do have these legacy things, you know, which, like, the DC Fontana one is great and stuff like yeah. that, and Peter David, and hearing, you know, these perspectives. And they're definitely, you know, very sort of, like, formally written kind of things. But then you get to Larry's, and I mean, I'm sure he had stuff prepared. I'm sure he had stuff written out. But it feels much more sort of, like, stream of consciousness. It's much more geared towards the medium that he's in instead of just, you know, because, I mean, Larry's obviously written, well, he's written a few books, you know, he's obviously a writer who would be perfectly capable of writing an essay for a published version of this book. But I think he realized maybe that he could take advantage of the format and sort of make things more conversational in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's fun, you know, hearing him talk about that for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I really enjoyed all of the afterwards, and I actually, you know, and this is where I really give the voice talent a lot of credit is in the afterwards. Obviously, DeForest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy can't read their own. But the voice actors that they got to read, you know, it felt like they really got to the right emotion behind the words that were being written. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's the same with the actors that they got to, you know, play known roles in the teleplay. They're people that had a good handle. It's sort of like the best thing I could say would be it's like Brandon Routh as Superman in Superman Returns. It feels right. These voice actors that they got really excel even in the afterwards.
It's on the whole, it's a really good set, you know. I mean, 8 hours worth of material. It's not just, you know, I mean, I even if you've read the book, you know, if you've read the screenplay, if you've read the comic, I mean, that's one thing. Hearing actors perform it is something else entirely. But even in addition to that, like, just everything that you get and hearing it in this format, I think is really kind of valuable. And it really does add something to it. It's not just an audiobook version of what's been written. There's really something more to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So definitely check it out. It's from Skyboat Media. If you go to skyboatmedia.com, you can find all the information there. You can purchase the book and everything. It was part of a Kickstarter campaign, you know, which got the ball rolling, which is really cool. So the fans were sort of what made this happen, and now it's available. So go check it out. It's definitely worth it.
I think it'd be safe to say our highest recommendation.
Yes.
To go and get this. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever star rating we have, this is the most stars.
Yes.
All right. Well, it's been fun talking about The City on the Edge of Forever today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
We've been waiting so long to cover material and it's still not covered yet, and now we might go to the complete other extreme and let's just jet through it all as fast as we can.
Damn you, Brian Fuller, you've given us too much Star Trek too fast.
The orb.
You put your action figures on the table or whatever in your house, you know, they don't move. You know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've got one of Picard right over there, and when he doesn't do what I want, I put him in the box. And I put it in the cabinet.
Straighten your shirt, Picard.
Meta Treks.
Well, I mean, if you're just talking sheer cool, I don't think there's any argument that Worf and Jadzia's wedding was just absolutely cool. There was a dramatic element to it. It wasn't just a ceremony.
Performative bloodletting. Yeah. That's how Klingon weddings go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows, see what it is that we've been saying and all this other stuff on other places, you know, and you find us wherever you get your podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, whatever. You'll find us, right?
The choice is yours.
Exactly. If you're an Apple user, hit the subscribe button there. You know, that really does help us out. Makes it easier for other people to find the show. It pushes us up in the iTunes search whatevers. And, you know, then more people will be exposed and to our show. And that'll make us happy for sure.
Yes.
We definitely want to give a shout out to our associate producers, Chris Steftenagel and Jeff Sutter. Thank you very much for supporting the show. It's kind of mind-blowing that here we are 5 episodes in and we've got not one but 2 associate producers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate it. And hey, if you want to be like Chris and Jeff, and who doesn't want to be like Chris and Jeff, you can become an associate producer. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you'll find all of our current goals for the network, our different milestone contribution levels. You can find out, you know, what perks there are for patrons, and you know, hey, you know, even if you're able to just spare a couple cents, we would be very appreciative of that.
Every bit helps.
It certainly does. So head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm, and check it out. All right, we have an iTunes review.
Yes,
it's from Davis.
Thank you, Davis.
Davis says, "What a great show. 5 stars. Mike and John are doing a great job to give you insight to all the behind-the-scenes info to different projects that people of Star Trek have worked on and developed. The David Mack interview was great. Their interview and review was fantastic. It inspired me to go and buy both books to read the stories. Great job, fellas. Keep up the great work." Thank you, Davis.
Wow.
Really appreciate that.
High praise. Yeah. Thanks. That's really appreciated. Very much.
Yeah. Be like Davis. Leave us a review. Leave us a rating. That helps us out, too. And, you know, we'll read your review on the air. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you?
Castle Junkie, all over the place. And you can also find me on Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast over on the Nerd Party Network.
And you can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, which is our daily rewatch for the 50th anniversary, where we look at 2 episodes every day, every single day. We're into the Deep Space Nine era now, so we're doing a lot of bouncing back and forth of Next Gen and Deep Space Nine, so go ahead and check that out. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right, well, that's it for City on the Edge of Forever, a project which was, but at the same time never was. And next week, we're going to be talking about another project that never was, another Star Trek show that never was, Star Trek The Final Frontier. And we're going to have the creator of that show, Dave Rossi, who is also a producer on Enterprise, on to tell us all about it. ¶¶